The protests continue in Egypt.
What are the potential ramifications for the global economy?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Monday, the last day of January.
Coming up, turning the tables on the fashion industry. Now consumers get to set the trends.
Also, salt to melt snow can be very expensive. You're not going to believe what they're using in New Jersey instead of salt to save a little money.
But first, let's get to the big story, the protests in Egypt and what they mean for the global economy. Sam Stovall is chief investment strategist with Standard & Poor's Equity Research, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So first of all, explain why what's going on in Egypt matters so much to global markets.
Well, I think that investors are using the tensions as a catalyst to digest the 24% advance in share prices that we have seen since August. And what they're also trying to do is to ascertain what kind of an effect this will have, because by itself, Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen represent less than one half of 1% of global GDP,
right.
And the entire 21-nation region represents about 3.5%. So by itself, it's not the big issue.
So it's really a question of whether this is going to spread to other countries in the region.
Exactly. If we find that the Suez Canal gets shut down, if we find that this political tension spreads to oil-producing countries and thereby disrupting output, well, then we could see higher gasoline prices here that could then result in lower consumer confidence and a threat to our economy.
And Sam, quickly, do you think that this situation has the capacity to really cause a slowdown in global markets the way, say, the European debt crisis did?
Not yet. Our belief is that it probably will end up being curtailed or contained in the Middle East, North Africa region, and that as a result, it's something that will end up being a blip for all of 2011. But I think because things are so uncertain, because geopolitical issues can get out of control like wildfires, that Wall Street is certainly paying very close attention.
Sam Stovall, chief economist at Standard & Poor's Equity Research, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
And we'll have more Egypt coverage coming up in the Global Perspective in just a few minutes.
Now let's get to some of the other stories we're following. In just a couple of days, Rupert Murdoch and Apple executives will unveil The Daily. It's a new multimedia publication being built exclusively for the iPad. Just don't call it a newspaper. From Silicon Valley, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Like everything Apple touches, The Daily is being built in secret. But Damon Kisau, a digital media fellow at the Poynter Institute, went digging through the computer code on The Daily's website and found mock-ups of its front page.
With some fun headlines, Oprah's Biggest Gamble and A Bridge Too Far.
So The Daily's vibe sounds kind of like a national version of the New York Post. The publishing industry is just as eager to get a peek at The Daily's business model.
The Daily won't be running Apple's iAds, which are Apple's internal advertising service for their mobile devices.
Instead, News Corp will sell its own advertising, and if The Daily knows its subscribers, it could target ads to each person based on the time of day, even location. But if Apple keeps all of that information to itself, individually focused advertising will be impossible, and The Daily might end up looking a lot more like an old-fashioned newspaper than Rupert Murdoch would like. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Well, for about a third of the U.S. population, this is going to be another stormy week. A huge winter storm, Steve, is expected to bring snow and ice to Texas, Maine, and just about everywhere in between, including right here in New York. I know you guys out in Los Angeles, you don't have to deal with this stuff. But
oh, it's
been
chilly
a rough
this morning,
winter.
Though. It was chilly. It was like 49 here this morning, Jeremy.
Well, Steve, in many places out here, there's already a lot of snow on the ground, and local governments are worried they won't have enough salt to keep the roads clear. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, here's Eve Tro's report.
Morton Satin is vice president of the Salt Institute in Washington, D.C. He says sodium chloride is everywhere.
It's just salt, of which we have a limitless supply.
But in winter, it's more difficult and expensive to haul salt. So, he says, governments need better planning.
That means investing in the infrastructure to store as much as you need locally.
He says that need is getting harder to predict.
Our pattern appears to be changing.
salt won't melt snow in extreme cold, Satin says. But now northern states are having warmer winters, so they're using more. Plus, the Midwest and South are getting snow when they didn't used to. South Carolina transportation engineer David Cook says his state spent all its emergency funds on a recent storm.
We don't really even budget for winter storms because we may go a year or two where we really don't have any.
Now, his department wants to build more sheds to store salt, but there's no money. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Well, salt isn't the only thing you can use to clear snow on the roads, Jeremy, in Bergen County, New Jersey.
Yeah.
Guess what they're using to melt the ice? Think about this.
What?
Now. It's not a blow dryer. I mean, I don't know where you would go with it. Pickle juice.
Pickle juice. Wow.
Yeah. The brine apparently is much cheaper. It's $16 a ton for the pickle juice versus $63 a ton for salt.
Well, that's a big savings.
Plus officials. Yeah, it is a big savings. And think about the area where they are. They're just right across the Hudson, right, from New York City.
Right, that's right.
So officials say with all the delis around, the pickle juice should be easier to find than any salt. Of course, you guys
don't
want to
know.
Salt.
I don't want to know what this is going to mean for the smell emanating from New Jersey.
There was a blog actually today where I found this story. It was an interesting little blog. Yeah. And there were the comments. And one of the commenters in the blog said, does New Jersey really need another smell? That was pretty funny. You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, January 31st. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles on Twitter at Radio Chio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson. Now, let's get to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. We'll start back with the crisis in Egypt. Many of the protesters that are calling for change in the streets are under 30. Some are recent college graduates disenchanted with Egypt's economy and the growing gap there between rich and poor. Marketplace's Scott Tong has more now on the economic factors behind the movement.
On paper, Egypt's economy is growing at a nice 5% clip and opening up to the free market. Big government is shrinking and foreign investors keep coming. But on the street, inflation is 12%. And Georgetown University's Samer Shahata says the vast majority of Egyptians aren't keeping up. And it's across the Arab world. Case in point, the young vendor in Tunisia who set himself on fire last month and died.
The gentleman who set all of this off, the 26-year-old high school graduate who resorted to selling fruits and vegetables in a stand, he is symptomatic of the condition of millions of people in the Arab world.
Millions who believe the riches have gone to a select few. Shahata estimates unemployment among college grads is 30%, and they're turned off by the notion of free market economy.
And I think what we're going to see in the future is a less enthusiasm, if not some hostility, towards these kinds of policies.
For the moment, the situation for young people may get even worse. Many are employed in the tourism industry, which for now is standing still. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Now inside Egypt, Naguib Sawiris is chairman of the Egyptian telecom company Orascom, and he's with us on the phone this morning for a business perspective there. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
My pleasure.
What's the business climate been like in Egypt?
Well, it was doing great. Our economy was doing actually great in comparison to the Europe and all the emerging markets. We were growing by 5-6% even during the crisis, you know. Right now, with this development, of course, we'll put a shade on the situation here on attracting new investments. But in my personal opinion, it is temporary. I'm very optimistic, you know, because we believe that democracy will happen here. And democracy is the best guarantee for investments long term.
You have Orascom, which is a big telecommunications firm. Were you asked to shut your cell service down?
Our license gives the government all rights to suspend any service they wish when national crisis or whenever they feel. So we have just adhered to whatever the government decides. We have no jurisdiction to, because our license gives them that right.
What did you think of the decision to do that?
At the beginning, yes, maybe, because if they wanted to avoid the turmoil. But I think right now they should restore the service. Otherwise, they're paralyzing all the business correspondence. We are unable now to continue business as usual. In today's world, you cannot do any business without your emails.
What about business going forward in Egypt? I mean, does it all depend on how these protests sort of carry through?
No. I think, as I tell you, I'm speaking for many serious businessmen in Egypt here. We believe that a real democratic regime here will enhance investments, will be the best security for people like us to grow and invest more, you know. So if there is a temporary setback now, so our stock exchange is suffering now, my feeling is this is going to yield into something very positive.
You're not fearful for your safety or any your family?
Well, you're talking to the wrong guy. You know, fear is not in my vocabulary. I fear no one except God.
Naguib Sawidis, the chairman of the telecom and construction giant Orascom, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Well, global markets are reacting to the situation in Egypt, and Jennifer Hughes is following that part of the story. She's senior markets correspondent for the Financial Times, and she's with us from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, we've heard that Egypt is not a major supplier of oil. The GDP there is actually smaller than the GDP in the state of Connecticut. Why are investors around the world so concerned about what's going on in Egypt?
Okay, you're right. It's definitely not about the amount they have in their portfolios that's directly related to Egypt, but it's about the bigger political significance. I mean, this is a massive U.S. ally, massive ally of Israel. So if we have unrest there, it could spread. And you know, with markets, it's all about what they don't know and what they fear.
This is about uncertainty. What are they concerned about? I mean, is there anything that we know that investors think might happen going forward?
Well, if you think about the markets and how we've had a lot of what you might call worst-case scenarios actually coming true in the last few years, investors are pretty cautious these days. We're looking at the Suez Canal and what happens if shipping there is disrupted. They're looking at if unrest spreads to other countries in the Middle East and what happens perhaps to oil supplies if that happens. There's construction companies have a lot of work out there. You know, you name it, investors can find a reason to worry about it right now.
Jennifer Hughes, senior markets correspondent for the Financial Times, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
World and economic leaders wrapped up their meetings in Davos, Switzerland, and critics say the event really didn't do much to help the global economy. Marketplace's Europe correspondent Stephen Beard reports.
It's not a G20 world, it's a G0 world. That phrase from U.S. economist Nouriel Roubini may be the forum's takeaway message. He said there's a lack of leadership among the big nations. The standoff between China and the U.S. over alleged currency manipulation continued in Davos. And while some politicians called for much tougher regulation of the banks, the bankers complained of the danger of being strangled with red tape. All in all, says Sean Rickard of the Cranfield School of Management, the Davos delegates did not provide a clear roadmap for the year ahead. But then he claims they failed to do that before the meltdown.
Did they foresee these crises coming? Did they warn about them? No, they didn't really. It's the place to be seen. Whether it actually contributes anything of any real value is, I think, a matter of debate.
He says the real business in Davos is done quietly behind the scenes between company bosses putting out feelers and striking multi-million dollar deals. The details may not emerge for months or even years. I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update for Monday, the 31st of January. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles and on Twitter at Radio Chio.
Oh, do you want to? Let's take that out.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, that's fine. You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, the 31st of January. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. You can give us your feedback anytime, day or night, by going to marketplace.org and clicking on the link that says Contact.
The Microsoft Kinect is not about contact. It's about raising your arms and never having to hold any kind of module or controller. So the game system plugs right into your Xbox console. Users don't have to press this or toggle that. And Kinect uses these sensors, Jeremy. You've seen this, haven't you?
Yeah.
These cameras, even voice recognition to track where you are. So it sees what you're doing in your own home.
Huh.
Sound a little creepy?
Sure does.
Yeah, here's reporter Sally Herships.
Katja Schroeder and her husband Henry True live in Brooklyn. They have a 4-year-old daughter, and for Christmas, the family bought a Kinect, Microsoft's new game system. They set it up in their living room and went on a virtual whitewater rafting trip. As they were playing, the game snapped pictures of the family. And at the end, they were flashed on the screen.
And we were like, what? What are these pictures doing and where are they going? And so Henry was immediately running to his computer and checking where they're going.
Nowhere, without their permission. Microsoft says photos and videos are saved to the Xbox, but users can upload them to ConnectShare.com, where files can be shared online or downloaded. Schroeder and True were still concerned.
You don't want to have pictures of you being distributed if you don't want them to be distributed.
I mean, you know, you can't play this in your underwear.
At a recent presentation for investors, Microsoft said the ability to see into consumers' living rooms means advertising opportunities. Kinect's cameras can be used to identify people or objects, then share shoppers' preferences with advertisers. Brett Gordon teaches marketing at Columbia University.
They don't want to show you an ad and think that you may or may not buy. They'd like to really, really know that that's going to be such a well-placed, well-targeted ad that you have a really high likelihood of buying.
Gordon says if Microsoft could count the number of people watching ads, they could charge advertisers more. Microsoft says this isn't part of their current plan. But would consumers let cameras in their living rooms? Betsy Mackay says yes. She lives in Dallas and describes herself as a busy working mom.
So the fact that advertisers are targeting me because they understand more closely what I like and what I might be interested in buying, I mean, that's good old capitalism at work. That just made my life a little bit easier.
Microsoft says the targeted ad capabilities of the Kinect are only an idea for the future. But if you are a Kinect owner now and worried about privacy, follow Brooklynite Henry True's advice. Keep your clothes on. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
It's pretty typical for businesses to make decisions based on what consumers want. But for decades, the fashion industry has bucked that trend. Instead of the market driving fashion, fashion has driven the market. But now, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, that's starting to change.
There are moments, flipping through dresses on racks at a store, when I see something truly terrible, like a really ugly barf brown dress, and wonder what in the world the designer was thinking. But soon, those fashion whiffs could become much less frequent as data mining comes to haute and not-so-haute couture.
The fashion industry in particular has been fairly closed for a while, I think. It's always been a little bit top-down.
Jess Lee is the co-founder of the fashion site Polyvore, which allows you to make collages of your favorite clothes. Think magazine fashion spreads, matching high and low-end fashion from all over the web. And when you choose to include that Prada blouse in your collage, maybe with that skirt from H&M, Polyvore keeps track.
A new Polyvore set is created every 3 seconds. So we're just sitting on a very large gold mine of data about products, what products people want, what brands are being used, what trends are on the rise.
All that data allows designers and buyers to see how potential customers interact and don't with their different styles. Designers can track performance of their brand on Polyvore's analytics site. They can also see what trends are doing well for other companies. And they partner with the site to run contests, encouraging people to style with their newest lines. And all the new data that's out there is really changing what fashion is. Marshall Cohen is a retail analyst with the NPD Group.
Fashion, which was always known as a very risk-taking and very avant-garde and forward business, has been pressured over the last decade to find new ways to be able to be just as profitable as any other area in retail.
Information generated by sites like Polyvore and other online fashion communities can help reduce risk, which means that in the future, that frumpy brown dress may not wind up on the 90% off rack or even getting made in the first place. But it also may become harder to find something really unique. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Well, Adrienne's done a Polyvore collage of her own, and you can submit one of your own at marketplace.org. Finally, Chinese state television, Steve, broadcast a video last week showing off a new fighter jet.
Mm.
But to a lot of people, the footage of the new J-10 fighter looked pretty familiar. In fact, the shots of a missile destroying another jet in midair looked exactly like an explosion from the 1986 movie Top Gun. I've seen the video. There's just no question about it.
Right,
it's the same thing.
Right.
Well, China's Central Television hasn't admitted any wrongdoing, but the footage has been removed from the channel's website.
They
but
probably
you can still rent Top Gun.
The producers of that movie probably asked for royalties like immediately. You're going to put it on closed circuit television. You've got to pay us some money.
Intellectual property theft has reached new heights in China, it looks like. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.